Hi, everyone. This is panel show producer and host David Shore. I just wanted to say there's a possibility you might hear some light jazz underneath some things tonight. I live right in downtown Toronto, and about 10 minutes before we were going to start recording, someone started playing a saxophone out on the street in my neighborhood. It's been quiet all week, but now there's a saxophone, and I've done the best I can with soundproofing, so I do apologize if you do hear light jazz throughout the show. At this time, before we start the podcast, I'd also like to address the two biggest stories that have occurred in Canada since our last episode. They are, of course, the discovery of the mass graves containing the bodies of 572 murdered Indigenous children at residential school sites across Canada, and the terrorist attack that took place in London, Ontario, that killed an entire Muslim family, leaving only their 9-year-old son as a survivor. Now, we're not going to discuss either of these two important stories tonight, because while the panel show is a news and politics podcast, it's also a comedy podcast, and there's just nothing funny about these two stories. We don't have a writer's room. We don't even have any writers. The improvisers are literally making up their responses on the spot. So if you're new to listening to this podcast and you ever wonder why we don't talk about some of the bigger news stories, that is why. Now, we've never asked for donations to help run the show, but if you are a fan of the show and if you are able, I would ask that you please make a donation to the Indian Residential School Survivors Society or to the GoFundMe campaign set up to support the 9-year-old survivor of the London, Ontario attack. You can find both of them by searching Google. Thank you for your support. The podcast will begin shortly. If you enjoyed this episode of the Panel Show podcast, please leave us a review and hit subscribe wherever you get your podcast. Thank you for listening. Hey everyone, welcome to the Panel Show podcast. Each month we bring together two real journalists and two improvisers in character to talk about real world issues, topics, and events. This episode is being recorded on Tuesday, June 22nd, 2021, live from our own homes over the internet via Zencastr. I'm your host, David Shore. Let's meet tonight's panel. First, our journalists. He's the Queen's Park Bureau Chief for the Toronto Star. Please welcome back Robert Benzie. Hello, Robert.
Hi, David.
And he's a columnist for the Globe and Mail and a member of CBC's At Issue panel. Please welcome back Andrew Coyne. Hello, Andrew.
Hello, David.
And tonight's improvisers are appearing as he's the heavyweight champion of the world and the subject of the films Rocky 1 through 3. Please welcome the completely fake 1982 Rocky Balboa. Hey, champ, how are you?
Hey, yo, thanks for having me here. And I just want to say that might be my buddy Frank Stallone out there playing saxophone. So make sure you say hello, okay?
Well, I definitely will if I go out later tonight. And rounding out the panel is the not real Dean the Troubled Teen. Hi, Dean. How are you?
Oh, right. Yeah. Yeah, good. Thanks. Yeah.
Okay. Well, welcome, Dean. Now, before we go to our first topic, I just want to thank everyone, all of our listeners who voted for us to help make the panel show a finalist for two Quill Podcast Awards. While we didn't end up winning either award, it was a thrill for our little show to be a finalist. And this show, tonight's show, will be our last show before our summer hiatus. And the reason why it's going to be shorter is because I'm a bit burnt out from reading the news so often. I bootstrapped this show and I need to take a break from reading the news, which dovetails nicely into our first topic, online comments. As an experiment and in an effort to protect its staff and journalists from mental and physical stress and threats, the CBC announced last week that it has turned off the comments section on all news posts on its Facebook page for a month. The announcement caused an online backlash, and the hashtag #DefundTheCBC started trending. Now, I'd like to read a paragraph from the editor-in-chief and director of daily news at the CBC, Brody Fenlon. He wrote an article published on their website announcing the experiment. Quote, "If public discourse is a litmus test of the health of a society, the conversation on social media suggests we have a problem. It's one thing for journalists to deal with toxicity on these platforms. It's another for our audience members who try to engage with and discuss our journalism to encounter it on platforms such as Facebook and Twitter, where they are almost guaranteed to be confronted by hate, racism, and abuse. Now, because of this atmosphere, the CBC has had to limit which news stories they've posted on Facebook. Finland's article also quoted the Globe and Mail's Andre Picard's recent column titled, "The Invisible Wounds Inflicted by Pandemic Journalism." In it, Picard writes, quote, "For journalists, platform like Twitter can be a great way to find sources and promote their work, but also a cesspool of hatred. Increasingly, reporters are also physically attacked," end quote. The column further points out that for reporters, covering COVID-19 or the opioid overdose epidemic can be just as traumatic as covering a war. The announcement also referenced CBC President Catherine Tate's article published in the Toronto Star earlier this year about the increased abuse of journalists on social media, especially for women and journalists of color. So panel, what are your thoughts about the CBC's experiment? Andrew Coyne, why don't we start with you?
I think they should go much further. I think media organizations ought to shut down their comments sections. You know, David, the internet was a lovely idea, but it ran up against the crooked timber of humanity. So the notion that people could just, we would just let anybody broadcast to anybody in real time to millions of people around the world, the first thing that came into their head, no matter how racist or depraved or crazy it was, we've never had that in world history before this. And frankly, we're not ready for it. I'm not suggesting we should censor it, but we don't need to provide platforms for it either. And what we've discovered, not just with the comment sections, but with Twitter and Facebook and social media generally, is if you want to have a decently functioning public square, you need gatekeepers to it. You need people to kind of weed out the crazies and the Nazis, et cetera. Again, I'm not talking about censorship. I'm talking about whether you provide platforms for these people. And I think I know why news organizations do it. It's because it drives readership, because the people who are commenting show up to see what the other commenters have written. But they do so at enormous cost to their brand. They you know, when you read the comments section of any major news site, it makes the news site itself look stupid and all of its readers in it, and therefore its writers look stupid. And I think, as I say, I think the CBC is well advised not just to make this an experiment, but to make it policy. And I would hope that the other news organizations would follow.
You know, one of my follow-up questions was, do you think that this should just apply to social media or even like on the Globe website? Do you think that all there shouldn't, is there a need for comments?
Unless you're going to have moderated, some kind of moderation, which is expensive and difficult to do. But people are obviously experimenting with that and perhaps you can keep it down. But even the best moderator, frankly, you know, when we used to run letters to the editor, we do run letters to the editor, you only publish the best ones. And It doesn't mean you only publish the ones that agree with you. And in fact, a newspaper or a news organization looks good when it publishes people who violently disagree with it, but violently disagree in an articulate and engaging and interesting manner rather than just people frothing at the mouth.
Dean, the troubled team, what do you think about all this?
Thanks, David. First of all, CBC, I don't really listen to it. My grandma does, though. Like when I visit her, we always sit down for, you know, an hour. I mean, she used to make me sit and listen to Stuart McLean, right? But anyway, like my mom works at the Brighton Tattler, right? And, that Maud Lucier always comes in and complains every week and says she starts jabbing her finger in the Tattler and saying, look at all the spelling mistakes in the obituaries, right? And you know, they got her Goose. They gave her a job. She'd complain all the time and she like, and then they took the fun out of it for her. So now she's in there reading all the obituaries and correcting the spelling.
Okay. Robert Benzie, what do you think about the experiment and what do you think about comment sections?
I agree with what CBC is doing. I mean, the Toronto Star got rid of our comments on our website after stories in 2016.
Okay.
Because as of January 2016, because as to Andrew's point, it demeans the and undermines the value of what you are actually printing on your websites. And I think, you know, when we run letters to the editor, but we check the letters of the editor, to ensure that they're, it's from a real person.
Right.
It's not just someone hiding behind a fake name or an avatar like they do on social media or on, you know, on news websites. So I just think Andrew's bang on. We need to have some gatekeepers to the public square, because it is ridiculous. And it's the stuff that some of my colleagues and I put up with, you know, I've a couple of Muslim colleagues who are subject to actual hate speech on Twitter, and Twitter does nothing about it. They're useless when it comes
to enforcing terrible at that.
Rules. I have a Jewish colleague in my bureau who gets anti-Semitic emails and hate mail sometimes, and it's just
so ridiculous. They're equal opportunity haters then, at least.
Yeah. They hate. Oh, I mean, the people, as you know, Andrew, the people who hate. I mean, and you have a good, you're good at fending them off on Twitter, and I try to do that too, and just try to. But I do also block the really racist people, just because I'm just not interested in their prejudices.
Yeah, I mean, Robert, I've noticed over time that you know, if someone gives like a jabs you online, you're like, thank you for supporting Toronto Star, the newspaper of record for Queen's Park, and Andrew, you just retweet stuff, but obviously the most brutal stuff you get rid of, and it's obviously very different for people of color and minorities and for women. I had, you know, a number of colleagues in the UK. Former students and people I perform with, and when they broke out, they all had to change their Twitter names because, as one friend said to me, the men found me. So it's a very different world. Right. 1982, Rocky Balboa. This might be alien to you. You know, I don't know if you know what comment section is, but you know, what are your thoughts on this, champ?
You know, I do know what it is, and I got to tell you, I'm a little bit jealous because, like, when I do a fight, right, like, I can't block anything out. Like, I've heard some pretty horrible things thrown my way. I actually had a chance to write some of them down so you could know what I've heard. I mean, people, they've called me a bum. They've called me a no-good bum. They've called me a worthless bum. And the one that hurt the most was a disgrace to bums. And I was like, I wish I could turn that off, you know? I think... some people got an opinion, but doesn't mean everyone needs to share it. Most of those comments, by the way, are from my brother-in-law, Polly. So it's been a rough time around the Rocky household.
Maybe you need to get him another snow cone machine.
Yeah. That might be a good idea.
So wait, the Globe and Mail presently does have comments, right? Is that correct, Andrew? I'm pretty sure it does. I subscribe to it.
Yeah, we do. And as I say, various news organizations have invested in various types of content moderation things. They're trying to do it now with AI. Mm-hmm. Or with readers voting up or down each other's comments. So it's not inconceivable. It's not impossible. You can certainly, I think, avoid the worst excesses. But to what end? You know, as I say, I'd rather read the letters to the editor section, frankly, than any comment section. And what's the difference? Because one of them is moderated or curated by a human being. With taste and judgment, and that, frankly, is things that we need. So the notion that, as I say, the notion that we all persuaded ourselves, and I was as guilty as anybody, that in the first flush of enthusiasm for the internet, that isn't it great? We can all just have unmediated access to everybody. If we want something that's of any value or worth, there is a role for editors. There's a role for editorial judgment. There's a role for discretion and taste and all these things that we sort of poo-pooed a few years ago. And I think we all kind of realize it now.
And Robert, was there any backlash when the Star got rid of its comments on the online edition?
I think, some of the readers who anonymously like to attack us were unhappy, but too bad, so sad. Frankly, I don't really care. Most of them aren't subscribers. They don't pay to read the paper anyway. So, I'm not particularly interested in pandering to them. And you also have this very unusual situation, David, where you could have someone libel the writer. Let's say Andrew or I wrote something for our respective newspapers and someone libels us in a comment.
Right.
We would be therefore could sue our own newspaper for libel, which would be kind of insane. But I mean, we are liable for the comments that are printed beneath our story. So I think that our lawyers thought it was a good idea not to have it. Our editors did too, and frankly, all of the reporters did because they just didn't want to put up with any of the toxicity. It's bad enough on Twitter and Facebook rather than having it on our own star.com.
1982 Rocky Balboa. Do you think that online newspapers should have comment sections?
Well, like, you know, I don't ever really read the newspaper, you know, like sometimes, sometimes I just kind of lean my head out the window and say, what's going on these days? And, you know, people tell me what's happening. You know, I mean, I found out about the pandemic about 3 months later, but, you know, if someone's going to always find a way to comment, I mean, in my neighborhood, there's always spray paint, you know, Rocky's a bum, that kind of stuff. So, I mean, maybe we should shut down brick walls in Philadelphia. I don't know, you know.
Dean, the Trouble Team, what about you? Do you think that newspapers, like their online edition, should have to have comment sections on their stories?
Well, you know, like David, what a luxury this online thing must be, because I don't know, I'm up at like 4 every morning doing my paper route, and I got to deliver papers. You think I have time to read them? No way, right? I mean, I don't know. This just seems like a bunch of fat cats.
Okay. You know what? With that, we're going to move on to our next and last topic. It is a shorter episode, and we're going to turn to Ontario, or as I like to call it, because I'm old, Ontario. I like to call it that sometimes. And we're going to talk about the notwithstanding clause, because the notwithstanding clause has been enacted for the first time in the history of Ontario. Now, the clause allows the federal and provincial and territorial governments to override certain sections of the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms for a period of 5 years. Conservative Premier Doug Ford moved to enact the clause after a judge struck down Bill 307, which limited third-party election advertising for 1 year before a provincial election. Rather than appeal the judge's ruling, the Ford government chose to go with the nuclear option, as the notwithstanding clause is often referred to. Now, Ford had threatened to use the clause back in 2019 when a judge struck down a new provincial law which cut the size of Toronto's city council nearly in half during an actual election. But that judge's ruling was overturned upon appeal, so the clause was never enacted. Here's a clip of Leader of the Opposition, Andrea Horvath, talking at a news conference on June 10th about the government's plan to enact the clause.
I think it's dangerous when governments do this kind of a thing. And I think it's dangerous when premiers or when any political leader thinks that the right thing to do is to muzzle, silence, and shut people down. We're a democracy. That has to stand for something.
And here's a clip of House Leader Paul Calandra speaking during the weekend-long marathon debate over the clause.
In Ontario, more money was being spent by third parties than all other provinces and federal elections combined. That is what the opposition is fighting to retain.
So, panel, why enact a notwithstanding clause now? Why not appeal the judge's decision before going with the nuclear option? Robert Benzie, you're the Queen's Park Bureau Chief for the Star. Why don't we start with you?
Well, it was time sensitive. They didn't. The government didn't feel that it could. It had enough time to appeal through the courts, because the election is on June 2nd, 2022. So they felt they had very little. They felt they had very few options, so they launched the nuclear strike, and whether there will be fallout remains to be seen. They seem to think that they have weathered the storm, but that was only a week ago, and I think that these kinds of constitutional headaches can leave a very long hangover, David. So I'm not sure that they're not going to regret doing something for the first time in Ontario history, invoking that notwithstanding clause. Quebec has done it about 19 times over the years, and it's always controversial when a government does it. So it's a little like, you know, blowing up your house to get rid of a mouse who is in the basement, because there's all sorts of. It's overkill, I guess you could say.
And it seems like, Robert, there was an opportunity, like both. All the opposition parties said they wanted to limit third-party spending, you know, different ways about it. Was there not an opportunity to come together and come up with something together, like an agreement?
Yeah, I think that they could have, and even the judge's ruling, Ed Morgan's ruling, seemed to suggest that a six-month limit would be fine. It was the extension of the limit on spending to 12 months that seemed to cause problems for the judge. And he said no. He gave them an opening. They could have called the legislature back and probably rammed through a 6 month stay, but instead they did 12 months. And the reason is they're afraid of union advertising. The Tories are very worried that public sector unions, the education unions, and others would have launched an onslaught of attack ads on Doug Ford. And they're not wrong. That would have happened. But the problem is, did they awaken new or other enemies that they perhaps didn't know they had by invoking the notwithstanding clause. That's what remains to be seen.
Dean, the troubled teen, what do you think about the notwithstanding clause being acted in Ontario?
Well, David, that Doug guy, he sounds like he reminds me of my Uncle Dutch, right? Yeah. He's a real blowhard. My dad gets real, it's his brother, his older brother, right? And my dad, oh boy, he gets so hot under the collar because Uncle Dutch just goes on and on, and he's like, I did this and I did that. I caught the biggest pickerel and blah, 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 blah. And he's just drinking. He loves beer. Like, one time he made a tower with his beer cans, and he's just a real dad calls him big fat head and a bully. It just, oh boy, if I want to see Dad red, I just say, hey, let's call Uncle Dutch, and there it goes.
All right. Andrew Coyne, what do you think about the notwithstanding clause being acted the first time here in Ontario?
Well, I mean, there's several issues. There's the bill itself, and I'll come to that in a second. There's Ford's use of the notwithstanding clause to protect the bill. And then thirdly, there's the whole issue of the notwithstanding clause and whether it should be. And it seems to me when it was brought in, the notwithstanding clause, as part of the constitutional changes in 1982, we were kind of sold a bill of goods that, well, you don't worry, it's only going to be used in the most rare and extreme circumstances when you've got a rogue court making crazy rulings and governments have to have the last word and blah, 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 blah. And in fact, when you look at how it's actually been used, it's usually used preemptively or to beat up on unpopular minorities, or in this case, I think to pick a fight, among other things. Right. So, you know, what the clause might have been supposedly intended to be for and what it's actually been used for have been two very different things, which should have been anticipated. If you leave a loaded gun lying around, somebody's going to pick it up and use it. And that's basically what the notwithstanding clause is. It basically says all of the rights in the charter that you thought were guaranteed. Let's say you were an observant religious minority in Quebec and you thought you were protected against discrimination by your government. Well, ha ha, the joke's on you. Actually, the government can do that if all they do is invoke the notwithstanding clause. And while it once might have been controversial, the effect of these things is the more you use them, the more you normalize them. Right. And so, as Rob mentioned, the government of Quebec has done it over and over and over again, and nobody even bats an eye anymore. And that's, I think, where we're headed in Ontario and other provinces as well. You know, I don't think anybody disputes that we need some sort of limits on corporate and union spending during election campaigns so they don't just completely monopolize the conversation. Right. But this bill, and remember, this bill basically just builds on a previous bill passed by the Wynne government. So there's a bipartisan effort here to muzzle speech. The Wynne government's bill banned not just corporate spending or limited corporate and union spending, not just during the campaigns themselves, but for 6 months previously, and not just on ads that supported or opposed explicitly a party or candidate, but on quote unquote issue advertising, if you could claim that this issue was identified with a particular party. So you're really getting very far afield from the original rationale for these kinds of controls. And all Ford did was come along and double it from 6 months to a year. And the fact that the judge was willing to countenance the 6 month limit just shows you how far, in fact, the courts are willing to bend over backwards to accommodate governments. Far from this notion that courts are just looking for ways to throw out every piece of sensible legislation, they bend over backwards to try to accommodate. I think this is very bad legislation, even apart from the use of the Notwithstanding Act. And I think we need to rethink how we approach this laudable idea of trying to make space in election campaigns and make them about the individual voters rather than about corporations and unions. And I think the simplest and best way is to say, we don't need a separate, extra harsh regime to limit spending by corporations and unions and other advocacy groups. We just need to bring them under the same umbrella as the parties. Because basically, whether you're contributing to a party or whether you're contributing money to, you know, the Audubon Society or whatever group that wants to participate in an election campaign, those are just basically alternate ways of projecting your voice into the political arena. So I think that's the ultimate solution to this thing, is to start treating parties and advocacy groups basically on a level playing field, rather than giving basically more and more latitude to parties to spend what they like, and then tightening these very draconian limits on third party groups. Because remember, it's not just unions and corporations; it's any group of citizens who are concerned about an issue and think that the parties aren't really addressing it. And under this legislation, they would not be able to advertise to except beyond a sort of a token amount, to bring these concerns to the public attention. I just don't see how we can possibly justify that if we believe in freedom of speech.
Andrew, I really think you need to think out your point a little bit more. no, and I did read, and you wrote a whole article about it, which I read, which is excellent, about you know, how the law, not just about the clause, but you a whole article about how this is really a bad law. 1982, Rocky, I know you really follow Ontario politics. What do you think about this?
Well, my favorite clause is Santa Claus, but everyone knows that, right? You know, I'm just kidding, right? I'm just playing around. You know, the thing about, what's his name? Rob Ford or Doug Ford? Who's in charge?
Doug Ford's in charge.
Right. Like, in a fight, when you're down, you can lose the first, like, two or three rounds of a fight, but still win in the end, you know, because you know that you're down and you know that you have to kind of change your way of fighting and boxing and stuff, but he seems to never know when he's down, which is usually most of the time. And he does things himself to just kind of, it's like he's punching himself in the face while sitting on the side bench when he's supposed to be getting his eye, you know, bandaged up or drinking water. He's continuing to just bring his own game down. So I don't really understand his policy, but maybe the people of Ontario should think twice before they elect someone for, you know, a buck of beer, you know, like that would be my advice to Canada.
That is good advice. I do wonder, like, does this, you know, law, you know, it's now a law here, does it give the Ford government an unfair advantage in the upcoming election next summer? I mean, there are conservative third party groups. Ontario Proud played a big part in Ford's victory. Dean the Troubled Teen, what do you think? Does this give the Ford government unfair advantage in the upcoming election?
Well, David, you know, like, I know, like, my Uncle Dutch would always steal my dad's allowance. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you something, my dad's never forgot it. Like, and he's an old man now. Mm-hmm. Like, he's 43. And oh my God, like, I don't know, sometime I think, you know, like, he one day he wants to get all that money back. He's been putting it, marking it down, and he's collecting interest, and Uncle Dutch isn't going to know what happens. I think Uncle Dutch would love this buck of beer guy for sure.
Okay, it's a bit off topic, but that's good. Robert, what do you think? Do you think this gives the Ford government an unfair advantage over the other parties in the upcoming election?
No, I don't know. I mean, the as you say, Ontario Proud helped them in 2018, and Working Families, which was the union coalition that won in court against this law, that which is why the Tories had to use the notwithstanding clause. That was funded by teachers' unions and so on. So, I mean, it's six of one, half dozen of the other. I think Andrew makes an important point about free speech, because the one of the clumsy things about this legislation, and it was the same under Wynne, and Ford has compounded it, because remember, the unions were challenging Wynne's law, and then Ford extended it from 6 months to 12 months. And then That's one of the reasons why the judge threw it out, because he was saying, well, wait a minute, how can you argue 6 months? And now you say 12 months, pick a lane, folks. Because remember, the Ontario government is the Ontario government, regardless of whether there's a new government in power, a new party in power. So I think, though, that they have an interesting challenge ahead of them, though, because let's say Andrew and I and Paul decide that we're going to do an environmental ad and say we are in favor of wind farms or something like that, or even something even more innocuous than that. Just, you know, pick up litter, please don't litter. That could be considered environmental policymaking, and therefore it could be restricted. I mean, if we couldn't spend more than $600,000 over a year promoting that. And God knows we want to spend more than $600,000 a year promoting that. But I mean, this is the problem. And the definitions in the legislation, the judge found, were very vague and problematic. And even Andrew's dog is concerned.
Well, I'm going to edit out Andrew's dog, so people are going to wonder what's that. But no, it's okay.
Why? I like the dog.
You like the dog?
It's better it's better than Frank Stallone playing the sax outside your window. It's
free speech, David. Why are you trying to limit my dog's free speech?
I have issues with your dog. I don't know anything about your dog. Your dog often does pipe in during the show for time, but that's okay. 1982 Rocky Balboa. What do you think?
Well, you know, it's weird. I was just on the Globe and Mail, and that dog has written some nasty comments on that website. So you might want to. But you know, if I was Doug Ford, I would get that "Where's the Beef" lady to do my ads. And they end up. She was gold. You know, I mean, she made me laugh, and I think that's what I would go with.
Okay, Andrew, do you think that this gives the Ford government an unfair advantage?
I can't see how it gives them unfair advantage. No, because the bill applies equally to unions, which might be expected to oppose them, but also to corporations and other groups that might be expected to support them. And if anything, I mean, yeah, they were probably facing much more of an orchestrated campaign by the union movement to bring them down. But I don't think it's unfair. I don't think they're required to sort of, in the name of even-handedness or whatever, just basically sit there and take that. I do think it's the interests of fair and free elections, as I mentioned, that we have some sort of limits during the campaign period on explicitly pro or anti party or candidate elections. Because if you don't have some control on that, then you basically have no control on party spending. Because party can just basically delegate it to third, quote unquote, third party groups. And I know they're not supposed to, you know, collude or orchestrate it, but who's kidding who? You don't have to explicitly get on the phone with each other to orchestrate these things. So you do need something during the campaign. As I mentioned, I think it should treat parties and advocacy groups on an even plane. But what you don't need is this kind of 6 months to a year of overkill where people can't even advocate their point of view on controversial issues. And I, as Rob mentioned, I think that the drafting of this bill is going to just be cause all kinds of headaches. I think the courts we're going to see some weird rulings on this that are going to probably outrage people.
I believe there is another challenge. Like I think Democracy Watch is going to challenge the notwithstanding clause ruling that it's allowed to happen.
Well, and also, David, the unions are actually going to launch another constitutional challenge, citing Section 3 of the Charter, which is not, which is about your rights to democratic representation, right, and your right to vote and your right to participate in the democratic process. And they're going to those rights are not. Cannot be overridden by the notwithstanding clause. So they'll be interesting to see. The last chapter on this one hasn't been written,
which just shows you how arbitrary the notwithstanding clause is. The people who like to invoke it say, "Well, the democratically elected governments have to have the last word on the courts," and leave aside whether anybody really has the last word. They don't apply that rule to the many sections of the charter that the notwithstanding clause doesn't apply to. But they also don't apply it to the whole rest of the Constitution. I mean, courts have been, quote unquote, making law by judicial interpretation, by interpreting the Constitution since, Confederation. It was all about the division of powers between the provincial governments and the federal government. And nobody seems to have a problem with courts, quote unquote, making law by making those judgments. It's only when the public got in the act, when it became a matter of not just the division of powers between one level of government and another, but between government and the citizens, then suddenly these people who were so concerned for parliamentary supremacy suddenly became, exercised about this. I think it's, I don't think it's really about democratic accountability or anything. I think it's just they don't like giving rights to unpopular minorities.
I'm thinking this is going to be a book written by Andrew Cohen. That's what I'm thinking here. All right. We're not going to play fact or fiction tonight. Instead, I'm going to ask each panelist for one thing they're looking forward to over the summer, and one prediction to make is something they think that might or could happen in the fall. So why don't we start with 1982 Rocky Balboa. Rocky, anything you're looking forward to this summer?
Yeah, I'm looking forward to just getting back to the movie theaters, because I don't know about you guys, I haven't found a Blockbuster video in like the last 6 months. I've been looking everywhere, and I can't, I want to rent like, a good movie or something like that. And I guess a prediction, for the fall is that you'll know the pandemic's over when someone just starts complaining about something that's like, this butter tastes like not salty enough or something, like when it's really lame complaints. That's when we'll be back to normal time.
All right. Robert Benzie, what about you? Something you're looking forward to and a prediction for the fall?
I'm looking forward to getting a haircut legally in Toronto very soon, David, because, of course, we haven't been able to do that legally in Toronto since
not a problem
November
for me,
23rd.
Yeah.
Yes, you're in better shape than we are. But I'm looking forward to that. I'm also looking forward to the end of the pandemic. I think that I think we are getting toward that as more and more people get vaccinated. So anyone listening, please get your shot, because the more that everyone gets vaccinated, the more that we can open up our economy and people can go back to work and wean themselves off of whatever assistance that they're having to receive from the government. And in the fall, in terms of the fall, my prediction for the fall is I suspect if the vaccination rates continue and the polling that we see, the trends that we see federally continue in terms of public opinion polling, I suspect that we'll see a federal election if Justin Trudeau, the Liberal Prime Minister, can somehow trigger one.
Dean, the troubled teen, something you're looking forward to this summer and then a prediction for the fall.
Okay. All right. Thanks, David. This summer, I'm really looking forward to going to hang out at the quarry. And with the sheet metal gang, and we're gonna skip stones and see who can skip the most. Last year I got 8.
Nice.
Wow. I got 8. That was pretty good. No one beat that last year. But seriously, my prediction for the fall is that Lonnie Glushenko will finally go out with me. And we're going to go have fries at Gibbs Diner.
It's pretty sweet. They got the best fries in town. That's pretty sweet. Andrew Coyne, about you, something you're looking forward to? And then I know you love making predictions, Andrew, for something in the fall.
Looking forward, I guess we hope we can travel at some point in the next little while. If not internationally, then at least across the Manitoba-Ontario border. Right. But we'll see how that, we're not out of the woods yet on this. The predictions, well, just to be contrarian, I'll predict that there won't be an election, federal election this fall. I suppose I should just put in parentheses that in fact, they're supposed to be by law fixed election dates. So it is remarkable how we just kind of glide over that and say, well, will the government call an election? The problem they got is twofold. One is they don't have really a convincing rationale as for why they need an election. They're not either at the end of their mandate where they've done everything they wanted to do and they need a fresh mandate. We just had a throne speech, less than a year ago. And they can't claim they're being obstructed by the terrible opposition parties who won't let them get their legislation through. Their legislation is passing fine. So they don't have a really convincing rationale. And even from their own, self-interested standpoint, they're not really far ahead enough in the polls just yet. They don't have enough daylight between themselves and the Tories. And even worse, the NDP are doing rather well. And Liberal election strategy always depends upon tamping down the NDP vote and scaring New Democrats into voting Liberal to beat the Tories. So unless the polling changes over the summer, I don't think they're there yet. I don't, if all they do is have an election and they just have another minority, what's the point?
Very nice. And, for myself, I'm looking forward to going to my sister's cottage. That's all I think about, which is another reason why this episode is shorter, because I want to get out of my place. And for the fall, I'm predicting to launch a new podcast called The Comedy Quiz. It's based off the fact of fiction that we normally do here, and that will hopefully launch at the end of the summer or in the fall. So do look for that. And guess what, everybody? That's the end of the show! Yay! I'd like to thank our panelists, Robert Benzie, Andrew Coyne, Paul Constable as the Not Real 1982 Rocky Balboa, and Lisa Merchant as Dean the Troubled Teen. Music for the Panel Show podcast was provided by Jim Clayton. You can get more info about the show on our website, thepanelshow.com, and you can also follow us on Facebook at The Panel Show Podcast or on Twitter at Panel Show Pod. My name is David Shore. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe and tell your friends. Have a great summer, everyone. Get vaccinated, and we'll see you sometime in the fall.